I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it.
Because we don't really need to talk shop. We're good.
Yeah, we whenever shop we talk, we text each other.
Yeah, we text each other, yeah. When we call and we talk and we do all that. And this is I Like to Movie Movie. My name is Dan Scully.
I'm Stephen Richards. I didn't think I would get that off in time.
Stephen Richards, who swigged his water bottle right at his cue. On Hot Property last week, we sort of hinted that we would be doing a Barbenheimer. Previously on Hot Property. Hot Property, where you properly talk about hotness. Hot Property. These snacks are scrumptious.
Scrumptious, but we
talked about how we might be doing a Barbenheimer double feature episode. But due to the insane popularity of both movies, Barbenheimer was not fully accessible, so we are just doing an Oppenheimer episode, but that's okay because we can do Barbie in the future, and there is a lot to talk about. Yeah, we can do it next I'd actually like to see it again.
The way that my schedule worked and my friend's schedules worked, we just couldn't get to the movies early enough to do the Barbenheimer special, because it was a Sunday, and we all agreed that we didn't want to go late into the night on a Sunday because we all get the Sunday scaries real bad.
Well, and Oppenheimer is a fuck ton of movie.
And Oppenheimer was a lot to digest, man. So let's just get into it. Unless you got to
talk about
some bullshit, like where you can find us at I Like to Movie Property Pod.
I'll handle this from here on out. You can find this show
One day I will surprise you.
You came up with the Twitter handle. I know when I was looking for a better Twitter handle.
I know.
So anytime you need to plug the show, just pretend I'm asking you what the Twitter handle should
be. What happens,
and then your first answer will be correct.
Here's what happens in my mind. I think is it Movie Cast? And then I'm like, no, you made it. It's Movie Pod. And then I'm like, no, you're wrong again. It's Movie Cast. And then I just trip over myself mentally.
I get it. Honestly, that makes the most sense. So, yes, you can find this show at Movie Cast on all of the things.
Yeah.
And then you can find our other show at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. Yes. So I get why this is confusing. I get why this is difficult. But I just wanted to say that in the coming weeks, towards the end of September, there's going to be some bonus episodes coming up, because I recently accepted press credentials to go to the one film festival that I've been dying to go to for a decade now. This is like high on my like dream list of things that I want to do. And it was to cover Fantastic Fest in a press capacity. And I was recently approved to do it, and I'm going to make the trip. So shout out to Fantastic Fest. A big thank you to them, because this is a little boy's dream coming true. And here's the best part. My hotel is about a mile away from the venue. And you know, it's dead center between the two.
Buffalo Wild
Terry
Wings.
Black's Barbecue. The world famous barbecue restaurant. So there's going to be some Hot Property material coming out of this, since Hot Property is almost officially a Food News and Sylvester Stallone Updates podcast. Well, there's going to be a lot of material.
Here's my question. Where's my fucking invite, right?
I mean, honestly, if you want to come, like, I don't know if you would be able to get in on a press pass, but you could certainly come to Austin. Jen is considering possibly going. I'm a part of this podcast too. That is true. And so I got approved on the strength of scullyvision.com, my website. That said, things could be arranged. So maybe we can talk some shit up. But I also would be remiss if I didn't take a moment up front to just speak very quickly about a recent celebrity passing, someone who's very close to this show. But just yesterday, the absolutely legendary Paul Rubens passed away after a private battle with cancer. And this is how I said it online, and I'll say it here too. Like, so much of my cultural style and personality and all of that comes from Pee-wee. The me that you know doesn't exist without Pee-wee Herman, and Pee-wee Herman does not exist without Paul Reubens. And he's given us so much. He's been the Penguin's father on two separate Batman properties. He was Flight of the Navigator. He was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He was the Spleen in Mystery Men, you know, and just came out of the Groundlings with tons of different characters that were all amazing. And by all accounts, he was a hell of a friend to everybody who knew him. And so I just, Pee-wee's something that's extremely close to my heart. And even though right now my dream project of having a Pee-wee versus Bean versus Brule movie can never happen, the fact that we had any Pee-wee at all, let alone decades and decades of it, is just remarkable. And Paul Reubens is a hero to so many people, and just like an icon for the childhoods of pretty much everybody my age, plus or minus 5 years. And it remains Pee-wee's Big Adventure is probably my favorite comedy movie of all time. It's certainly my favorite Tim Burton movie outside of maybe Batman Returns. So it just, Pee-wee was everything, and Paul Reubens was the man. So rest in peace, good friend, and thanks for all of the wonderful art and all of the good times.
Yeah, I was never as big into the Pee-wee verse as you were, or people around me at the time, but I know that I will feel this way about Conan O'Brien when that time comes.
Oh yeah,
because that is like, I think that is like a one-to-one relation of you and I. Like, I very much like grew up and studied at the school of comedy of Conan O'Brien, and I remember Conan actually had a story about Paul Reubens that I thought was really funny too, because it's something that I would do, which is every year for your birthday, if Paul Reubens had your phone number, he would just send you the most random and irreverent gif, often just the first one that would appear in like the gif keyboard, and it would make no sense. He wouldn't even say happy birthday. He would just send you a random gif that often had nothing to do with that. And a gif on the text messages. And I just thought that was a funny little thing, and it's a nice little memory that he shared again over his, that Conan shared on his Instagram, that I went back and listened to that episode with Paul Reubens afterwards. And he's just a genuinely, you know, happy dude. He loved life, and I'm not surprised that he did that battle in private.
Yeah, and I'd respect for doing it. He made a statement the night before he passed where he apologized for keeping it private and, you know, thanked the fans for the love and just said, I loved creating art for everyone. And I don't think that, you know, of course I accept his apology, but I don't think that he needs to, yeah. I don't think he owes us an apology. I think that, you know, everybody's suffering can be broadcast at whatever volume they choose. I don't know. He seems like a real class act, and Conan's not alone. So many celebrities shared thoughts about him, and almost every single one that I read, they mentioned that he never forgot their birthday. So apparently he really prided himself on being a fixture and sending everyone love on their birthday. And it's like, that's so beautiful. People forget, like, everybody has their own holiday dedicated to themselves, and it's their birthday. And the fact that he was willing to celebrate everybody's individual holiday, I think just speaks to what kind of a guy he was.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it's just like a tremendous loss. It's this is going to sound so schmaltzy, but like, I truly feel blessed to have existed on this earth in just the right window of time to have received all of Pee-wee and all of Paul Reubens' work. Yeah. It's like to have been a child when Pee-wee's Playhouse was being broadcast and to have seen a lot of it in that form. It's like, a cosmic roll of the dice that I happened to be there to receive it. And I just could not be more pleased. So RIP Paul Reubens.
You overshadowed the fact that Tony Bennett died a week and a half ago, and I didn't even realize it.
Oh, you didn't realize it?
No.
Well, Tony Bennett, also like total legend and like a truly good dude, like a true activist. And now that he's gone, maybe this is an opportunity to close the age gap on Baby It's Cold Outside recordings, because I know people have pushed back against that song stupidly, but it might be a little easier to swallow that song if the two singers aren't a woman in their 20s and a man in his 120s. So now we close that gap a little bit, and I think we can press on with a perennial holiday classic. It won't feel so rapey to the perpetually butthurt if it's not, you know, an Olsen twin and a extinct pterodactyl singing, you know, like we can close it, get them within 10 years and make it sure. Work. But you know, that's not let's me talk. I'm not the guy in charge of Christmas stuff. Let's talk Oppenheimer.
Let's talk about Oppenheimer.
Yeah, let's bring things up a little bit. Let's get more chipper and more happy, and we'll talk about a true American hero and a stand-up guy and one of the greatest gift
a champion of high-waisted pants everywhere,
J. Robert Oppenheimer. Yeah. So I'll just start with the basic question. Did you like the movie?
I did like the movie. I think this was... movie? I think I love the movie.
I do too.
It was kind of a lot, right? And I was one of those things where I need... It's definitely a rewatch for sure, 100%. But I think it was one of those things where I was like waiting for the bomb the whole time. And it was kind of hard to, like, you know, really take the movie in. Cause I was like, I was like, he's going to build a bomb soon. It's going to be very loud, you know? And, and I was thinking that the entire movie, but, and also, you know, just hard. It's especially with Nolan where he does. And I love that he does this, but like, he just will quickly cut. There's really not for somebody who has such long films, there's really not a lot of fat on the bone, because he will stop a scene once you are done with the information that you need to absorb from it. He'll just stop the scene there and just move on to the next thing. Like he is not shy about cutting away and intercutting scenes, laying dialogue scenes on top of one another, just so you're getting the highlights of each conversation. And I think that element is really great at building a lot of tension, which this movie does in spades.
I think that's like a Nolan trademark now, because like
it definitely, you know, is like Memento, Inception, he does it like almost every scene it happens.
Oh yeah, but I mean, like, so Memento, you know, that movie is designed to be cryptic about what part of the story you're getting, because you're watching it backwards. But then you look at something like our first episode together, The Prestige, and you know, you look at The Prestige, and that's a movie that follows like four different linear plot lines that are intercut between one another. Same thing goes for Dunkirk. And, you know, if there is a criticism to be lobbed at Dunkirk, and it's not one that I agree with, but it's one that I certainly hear, it's that because the events that they're cutting between aren't happening tandem in real time, it can undercut the tension. I disagree because I asked them thematically, but I think he really masters it here, because we're jumping back and forth from post-bomb to pre-Trinity Project to, you know, we're jumping all around in time, and it's indicated by the age of the characters, how they look with their makeup, by the color grading and the black and white of the screen. But the choices of where to cut in these three timelines, I think is like perfected here. Because yes, a conversation will end, but it's never random where the next one picks up. And I feel like it was calculated in such a way that when it's jumping around in time, there's such a strong thematic thread between moments where, you know, and I'm going to struggle to come up with an example because it's so long, but like there'll be a conversation that's happening, you know, what we'll call canonically like present. And then that conversation will cut and it'll not necessarily flashback, since it unspools like a montage, but it moves to a time before that.
Yeah.
And that conversation will have some sort of connective thread. And so the movie's kind of always like cyclically informing itself. And it just, it really felt like this was something that Nolan has been trying to do for his whole career. Yeah. And whereas I would argue he nailed it a few times in the past, this is the first time where, like, it was like watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where it's like, you've influenced a decade of cinema, and now this is your first film post that influence, where you're almost influenced by yourself. And it just, him coming into his own where craft meets story like that, was like, it felt really exciting to me.
And I think that the self-referential stuff, I just lost my train of thought completely. Shit, it was a really good point too.
Well, so we were talking about the way it cuts between what are seemingly disconnected stories but are thematically tied.
Oh yeah, so like that's how also it is. It's funny because this is how I remember most Nolan movies, but like the memory of scenes as I was like prepping for this podcast, they came back to me in the exact format of like the snippet that he uses. And yeah, like, yeah, it's kind of almost like he's giving us cliff notes of what he, of his version of the Oppenheimer story. Like it's almost like you're getting the, not quite the elevator pitch, cause it is 3 hours long, but if for each, you're getting the elevator pitch. A 3 hour essentially is an elevator pitch for somebody's lifespan.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. I guess like percentage wise, you're
kind of justify it that way. But, yeah.
That's actually kind of very well said.
I now I don't have a point to go because I was like, damn, just end there. I'll just end there. That was a good point.
Well, no, and I think you're right. I think the goal of this movie, I think, short of exhibiting Nolan's craft, is like trying to give a nuanced portrait of a time and a place, a man, and you know, an earth-shattering literally invention. I mean, there's that one line in the movie where Matt Damon, as I think his name is Graves, says, "This is the most important event in the history of the world."
He's like spitting everywhere.
He's spitting everywhere because, yeah. And that guy Graves, as I understand it, and this is of course taken from the 5-part last podcast on the left, devoted to the Manhattan Project that I listened to in anticipation of this, which highly recommend. It's fantastic. Graves was like the guy, he was like the one guy who knew every piece of the compartmentalization and just had to make sure each team got it together. So he was like a get it done kind of guy.
Wow.
But he's not wrong because the bomb itself, like that really is like, whether it's good, bad, or I'm not even saying any of that, but in terms of like, it changed what it means to exist. That's how big of a thing that is. And so this movie is like taking that and layering it over. Like there's no denying J. Robert Oppenheimer was a genius. There's no denying that like he had a vision that was almost inhuman. There's also no denying that he was an absent guy. He was a bit of a womanizer as depicted in this movie. He was a guy who, while he understood that he might be destroying the world, opted not to pull back because he wanted to see how far he could go with the science.
Yeah.
And then that's layered over the governmental issue of, we are about to invent a brand new toy. And the fact of the matter is, whether it's justified to use or not, the only way it's effective is if we use it at least once. And in order to do that, there's so many political strings to pull. And so all of that together ends up being this beautiful picture of just like, what is a human being? A human being is someone who must survive, who must thrive, who must create, who must advertise their creations, and must do so while trying to be as pure good as possible, despite knowing that there's no such thing as that. Yeah. And so by interweaving all of these things and having those thematic threads, you can really, like, it's a story about humans. And it takes that specific editing style that we're talking about, I think, to really drive that point home without explicitly being like, you know, like, you're probably wondering how I got here. And then we go back to the beginning.
I was really hoping that that's how the movie would open. Just like, you know, hey, it's me, J. Robert Oppenheimer. You're probably wondering how I got here with the bomb and everything.
Yeah. Call me Oppie.
Call me. That was the weirdest part of the movie, by the way.
Yeah.
But what's funny is,
as a joke, I called it Oppie. And then when someone called him Oppie in the movie, I was like, what?
Dude, when that happened, I was like, fuck, Dan was right. Because when you said Oppie, I was like, don't call it Oppie. That's so weird. And then.
Well, it was weird jumping from the Opportunity robot, the drone that we sent to Mars.
Yeah.
Because there's a documentary about it, a great documentary called Goodnight Oppie. Because Oppie is what they called Opportunity. And so it's just funny. I used to associate it with an inspiring robot. And now I associate it with a Cillian Murphy biopic.
Dude, that Goodnight Oppie documentary is the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life.
And they don't even have souls.
It's a robot.
It's a robot. What a great, it's such a great documentary, yeah. though. Because, but okay, so, you know, let's relate that to Oppenheimer, because one of the beautiful things about Goodnight Oppie is that he was set to exist on Mars for a certain amount of time. And then a sandstorm comes and they're like, we're going to have to terminate this program early because, you know, he's got a sandstorm, you know, hit him. But then that sandstorm, I forget how it went down, but that sandstorm like blew him onto an even better course. And the sandstorm blew all of the debris off of his charging unit. Like, because that was one of the things that was going to give him a limit, yeah. was that the solar power panel would get covered in dust, but then the storms would clear it off. And so then we find NASA is now steering this robot directly into storms in order to give it longevity. And like that to me is, that's the definition of science, because science, you know, we say things, yeah. like, I believe science, trust the science. And it's like, the thing about science is it's always in conversation with itself. And so you're testing to see if things work, how well they work, and what happens if they don't. And so then we have Oppenheimer, whose whole life is following that process. The only problem is the what happens if we don't is it might destroy the world. And what yeah. happens if we do is it might destroy the world. And, you know, and so it's the, and so now we are faced with the same, like, you know, what storms as society do we have to steer into in order to keep these bombs from going off now that they're here? You know, I think all my ranting aside, I think that Oppenheimer is such a more dense movie in terms of like humanity than it is about any one element of Oppie himself.
Yeah,
you know, the Trinity Project, you know, it's. And that's something that, as much as I love Christopher Nolan, I don't think he's ever hit something that deep before.
I would say Inception, but in a different way.
In a different way, but like, yeah. Inception, I think, you know, like,
to like, me, in a more, like, that was more of an emotional way, where this is more of a intelligently emotional way, if that makes sense. You know,
I think that makes sense. This feels more scholarly, because yeah, I do like, agree. Oh, like,
we are so fucked, like that kind of
yeah. thing. Well, at the end, like. In Inception, the one thing that bonds all of us is the fact that we all dream. Yeah. You know, everybody has a dream. So, like, you know what? And so then we ask questions about what even is our brain, and you know that, like, we all dream is certainly going to bond all humans, but not to the degree of we're all doomed.
Yeah,
and it's like, and so to dance with this tiger of like. We have to do these things that doom us in order to thrive, but we can't not thrive because, and so it's like, you know, science can give us the power of the sun. And there's two ways you can say that. You can say it as science can give us the powers of the sun, or you can say it as science can give us the powers of the sun.
Yeah.
And like, it's insane. Oh God, that movie fucked me up. Now I'm
like,
out.
Now it's like, all right, well, what's being worked on that we don't know about that they're going to make, that they might, that if they're around, could make a movie about in 100 years, you know?
Yeah. That's the craziest thing. Yeah. Oppenheimer did all that shit and he had no idea that one day he would just be a biopic.
Yeah. And less than 100 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, as I understand it, you know, let me ask this question. The biggest criticism I've seen of Oppenheimer so far, and it's one that, again, I don't know if I agree with. I need to see it again.
Can I say don't my think criticism is invalid. First?
Oh, yeah, please.
My criticism is that there wasn't enough of topless Florence Pugh.
My God. And you know what? We're going to sound like a couple Killian of
Murphy's
assholes.
Ass. Yeah, I want to see Killian Murphy's yeah. ass as well.
We're going to sound like a couple of assholes, but I will say this. There are times when nudity is used in movies that it's just meant to titillate. And, you know, that can be fine in its own right, but I can see why that's an issue for some. Sometimes movies will have nudity and it's nudity that serves the story. And I think that's the case here. I think it greatly
serves the
story.
I will say this, at least the scene where in the, like, the little courtroom, not like, I guess I can't say courtroom, like the little area where the small room where they're having the dissertation or the deposition, I mean. And Emily Blunt is staring at him and she's like having sex with him in her mind. I will say that is an exact depiction of what it feels like when you're staring at somebody who has cheated on you. And like that, because that's been me. I've had this exact moment, and I felt like that was an exact, like, one-to-one. Yeah. I've experienced that before, talking to the person that's cheated on me. And like, that's all I see now when I see them.
Yeah. Oh God. It's the worst feeling in the world.
It was, yeah, it's terrible. And they, I think they nailed it. Cause like,
and also Emily Blunt, like, absolutely fantastic in this
Emily
movie.
Blunt and Florence Pugh and Josh Hartnett in that order were my surprise three stars from the cast that's not Cillian Murphy.
I would say for me, it was Emily Blunt at the top. I thought it was just like I think she should get an Oscar for
this.
She's
going to get at least a nomination. At least a nomination for sure. If she doesn't get a nomination, I will burn Oscar to the ground.
There you go. Number two for me is
maybe that's why I'm not invited to Austin.
Jason. Yeah. Number two, well, actually, yesterday when I was describing my hotel woes to Jenna, I was like, I will burn the hotel down, and I will do it when there's children inside. So
oh my God. All right. No, they just tweeted.
I was trying to be funny.
I can't say tweeted. They just X'd. You're not invited either.
Well, I would never do that. I would, and if I tried, there's a higher chance I'd set myself on fire and die before any hotel did, because that's how dumb I am.
That's true.
My number two best performance in this is Jason Clarke as the guy who is grilling.
He was a dick.
He was a dick. But like, there's not a lot of space for just like the strange looking character actor to like really chew the meat. Like the Brian Dennehy's of the world. That's not a thing we see anymore. The Kevin Pollocks, you know, but I mean, last week's episode, Kevin Pollock is exactly that role. Mm-hmm. But Jason Clarke absolutely crushes in this. But his performance is nothing without the lawyer on the other side of the table, the guy representing Cillian Murphy. My number three performance goes to Macon Blair.
Is that him?
That's Macon Blair. We have a friend of the show, Andy. He has a rule that we call the Macon Blair rule, which is no movie with Macon Blair in it can be all bad. And it's true, because anytime he shows up, you get a couple minutes of like, right on, man. But he like gets a couple scenes and they're like big meaty scenes where he's got to stand up for his client. And man, that's like, ooh. But
wait,
back to your point, Florence Pugh is really hot naked. So yes.
Speaking of similar roles, David Krumholtz, plays the same role in this movie as he did in The Santa Claus, where he played Bernard the Elf, and I'll tell you exactly why. He shows up as if out of nowhere, with food in hand, offers the main character wise, sagacious advice on what his next move should be, and then disappears as if he was never there.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because to tie back to what we said at the beginning, that was a moment where it really started to first set in the previous scene that Oppenheimer had he started to really have the thoughts of, I have to finish this job and it will destroy the world. And as he's sitting there on the train, he goes to light up his cigarette. His best buddy comes up to him and is just like, have you eaten?
Yeah.
Would you like an orange? And he opens up a napkin wrapped orange, and it is so orange. It looks so juicy. And it's the only kind. But here's the thing. It's brilliant, because in that moment I went, God damn, that orange looks good. And J. Robert Oppenheimer has a look in his face of, I want to be sad right now, but
that's a
I
good
really
orange.
Should have this orange. Yeah. But at the same time, you look at that orange and you go, you know what created that orange? The very thing that this whole project is threatening to destroy. Yeah. You know, like, there are so many beautiful things in this world, but towards the top of the list is nature's ability to produce something as nutritious, tasty, aesthetically pleasing as an orange. And in this dry, arid movie filled with doom and gloom, his buddy's just like, have you eaten? Have an orange. And that is the best scene in the whole movie, if you ask me. That scene, for the rest of the movie, even as the Trinity tests and all that, I'm just sitting there like, damn, that orange thing was fucking legit. Like, I don't know. That to me said the whole movie right there.
My favorite scene was besides the, well, it's interesting because there was a point in the movie where, you know how on sets, like they will save money on actors or featured extras if they don't speak during their role.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, did they, like two-thirds of the way through the movie, I was like, did Rami Malek take a pay cut? Because he hasn't spoken yet, and we're like 2.5 hours into this thing, and he's just in the background. He just like take like not a full salary for this movie by not speaking in this whole film, and then he delivers like the best speech, the best fuck you speech, Robert Downey Jr., who turned out to be the bad guy, which is crazy. I like also, how Nolan took a M. Night Shyamalan twist, and he was like, by the way, the bad guy is supposed to be your trusted narrator.
And I will say this. I would put money down that I'm willing to bet that Cillian Murphy is going to win Best Actor.
Yeah.
I think Robert Downey Jr. wins Best Supporting Actor for
There's
this.
No doubt in my mind that RDJ is coming for the gold and walking away with the gold.
Yeah. Guaranteed nomination, but I think he could win. I mean, unless, you know, we get something like Everything
Unless Ever Crawled Daniel Day Lewis was working on the movie this whole time in a supporting way.
Well, at the end of the movie when Albert Einstein pulled off his rubber mask and then grew 3 feet and was Daniel Day Lewis, and everyone was just like,
okay, nice. But real quick, I know you're joking, but real quick, when he like came out of the dark in one scene, like he was it was very reminiscent of when Infinity War, when Captain America comes back to save Vision and Wanda, and I'm like why is Albert Einstein like getting like the superhero treatment right now?
Well, because he's the superhero, and you know, we're skipping ahead, but like that ending with the reveal of the conversation between them is like just masterful.
Also, that was very reminded me very much of The Prestige, which I loved, because I think that was perfect. That was a perfect flavor for that moment. And I think that the whole denouement in general, I had a blast going through. But I mean that pun intended.
Oh, I think it speaks to the themes of the movie as well, where it's like, we didn't have to drop the bomb on Japan, but we sort of felt like we had to drop it on somebody so that everyone knew it was real. Yeah. So we come up with all of these reasons, and not saying that Japan didn't do fucked up shit during the war. We all did. The world was at war. I mean, Pearl Harbor's horrifying, but you know, dropping bombs on two of their cities and killing, that's a big thing. Yeah. And so to try and moralize it, there was a very big cultural campaign to moralize why it's right. And what we're watching with the Robert Downey Jr. finish is when he's going after Oppenheimer for just dumb political reasons, mostly that Oppenheimer's just speaking out against weapons proliferation. He gets it in his head that something bad happened between Oppenheimer and Einstein that reflected upon me. They were talking about me. And he moralizes this whole thing for his crusade, and it's just not there.
But it turns out to be just a great vessel to tell the story of a guy who invented something that killed thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and wanted to take blame when nobody else was taking blame because he's the one that did it. And then when he tries to take that blame and that ownership, he's told by Gary Oldman as the president himself, this wasn't you.
President Truman.
Truman. Yeah, this is not you. So not only does he not get to accept the guilt, he doesn't get credit for his invention.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break, and we have a lot more to talk about.
Fucking yeah, sure.
Hey, everybody. Instead of an ad today, we actually have some input from one of our listeners. So shout out to listener Megan Minucci, who sent in her thoughts on Oppenheimer. So I'm going to pull a quote directly from one of our listeners here. It was a party weekend, so my voice is a little scratchy. Apologies for that. That was me, not Megan. Here are Megan's words on Oppenheimer. Quote, "The story is thought-provoking. While the visuals and soundtrack induce a visceral experience, a cinematically stellar portrayal of the struggles between science, government, and morality." So shout out to Megan. Thanks for submitting your words. Fellow listeners, reach out to us. Let us know what you think of some of the movies that we've covered in the past or movies that you would like to see us cover in the future. And we might include you in a future episode as well. So again, thank you, Megan, for reaching out. And as for everybody else, make sure you follow the show at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. And make sure you check out ScullyVision.com for the rest of that. I almost feel shitty going back to the second half of this because Megan said everything that we've said over the course of, you know, a 90-minute podcast in about 10 seconds. So we are remedial and Megan is a pro. But thank you, Megan, for contributing. And thank you, everybody else, for listening. We love you all. And now back to the show.
We're back.
So we're back. The big criticism that I've seen of this movie is after the Trinity test, the first showing of the atom bomb, the last like 45 minutes to the hour of the movie then slows down from its breakneck pace of leading up to the building of the bomb to becoming a political talky procedural. And I hear that complaint and I get why people have it. I don't think I share it. What do you think about that?
I don't share it either. I think it was fine.
Yeah.
It didn't jar me from my seat. I didn't even notice it until you said it just now.
Oh, fair enough. Cause I felt it, but I felt that it was appropriate because after the bomb, you have this big exhale. And then you think that it's an exhale, but then you realize like, no, it doesn't end at the bomb. This is a story that must go forever. And, you know, I think that having like all the hearing stuff afterwards, you know, but what's weird is that in the time since I saw it 2 weeks ago,
actions and consequences.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
You know, that's why it was probably jarring for me.
Looking back at it, though, that's the part of the movie I honestly think about most outside of that orange. You know, like the Trinity test was impressive and it was great to see, you know, just again, like just all of a rogues gallery of character actors. Just it was almost like each new character would turn around and I'd be like, that guy. But like even after all of that, like. I would think in my head on my way to see Oppenheimer, I'd be like, I'm going to be blown away by the bomb sequence. And then in the time since it ended, most of my thought has gone to the political procedure of the back half of the movie.
Small stuff.
Yeah, the small stuff. Because like the bomb was impressive.
Camera is shaking behind him as he has a panic attack, as the weight of the world crushes him beneath what he's done.
I got chills. Yeah, what about that one sequence where he's like talking to the crowd and it's like the dream sequence where they all get fucking toasted? Oh my God, that was like a horror movie. Oh
man, that was fucked up, dude.
And then, and honestly, the Trinity test though was really good. I thought it was the score. What's his name? Goran Goranson, is that what his name is?
Goran Goranson?
It's something like that. I know I'm just being ridiculous. The score is amazing.
Scorn Scorenson.
BB like that one. Ludwig Göransson. I don't know why I say Goran Göransson. Ludwig Göransson, who's a frequent Nolan collaborator, and also shout out to the cinematographer Hoyt van Hoytema. That Trinity sequence is a masterful craft.
Cinematographer.
So, yeah, for a camera boy. And the camera boy van camera boy, and I love how the score is like pulsating. It's absolutely incredible. And then the bomb going off, which as is reported by all of the people there, was silent for a good long time before they heard anything. And so to cut the sound there and have that and cut the music there, it was like breathless.
They cut the sound and they just included this like big ASMR style, like everybody breathing, every lip smack, every sweat drop. And then
That's how it was.
What?
I said that apparently that's how it was.
Yeah.
You know, apparently that's what, if you were there, it was dead silent because the bomb was not a loud thing.
I believe it.
I also like too that like all the guys hanging out there have like their sunscreen on their faces. Benny Safdie, one of the directors of Uncut Gems and other such classics, is just sitting out there with his sunglasses, his, you know. But then what's his name? Jack Quaid has like a special windshield that he thinks will protect him. But I love that even so, nobody was ready for it. Jack Quaid playing the bongos in that one scene. Somebody found a picture of the guy who he played in the movie playing bongos. So that was awesome. Not a choice made by the movie. That's like a real detail.
I'm sure that only Jack Quaid and Christopher Nolan knew that.
Probably. Yeah. And Jack Quaid probably didn't know it. He was just like, can you play these bongos? And Jack Quaid was like, I love bongos because my dad's Dennis Quaid. Why would I not love and bongos?
When, I remember when they celebrated the explosion, the first thing he did was reach for his bongos. I don't know why I remember seeing that.
When they celebrate, there's such a great moment where Oppenheimer's on the phone with, I think it was with Matt Damon, and he's, you know, after the success, but it's this a success that Oppenheimer's haunted by. And I forget the line. I'm gonna fuck it up, but I'll get the spirit of it. Matt Damon goes, how is everybody? And he says, oh, they're all really happy considering. And it's just like a throwaway like that where he's like, yeah, I mean, we're so joyed that it worked. The problem is it worked. We saw how fucking devastating this thing is as a weapon that we built.
And like,
we're all thankful we didn't light the atmosphere on fire, but.
As he leaves the room of everybody cheering him and him like, we should have, I wish we used it on the Germans, blah, blah, blah. And he goes outside and like all the scientists like throwing up because they realize what they've done. And it's, I think it's awesome. Not awesome in like a very, like that's cool sense, but like it's just awesome in the actual definition of the word that what they did was so awesome that they decided that like most of them decided, I don't want to do science ever again.
Yeah. I'm out.
Like, there's a lot of Icarus references. I've flown too close to the sun. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm responsible for thousands of lives and I'm out. And Oppenheimer was the only one that stayed on just to be like, I denounce all of this.
Well, so as I understand it, Oppenheimer was pretty close to becoming president in terms of his public persona was so positive after the bomb that he was, you know, going to get a lot of power. And that's a lot of what scared the political elite, the Robert Downey Jr.'s Stas, as they, I believe was his name. Strauss.
And not Strauss.
That's what scared him, is because here's a guy who's insanely powerful, very popular in the public eye. He's on the cover of Time magazine, and now he's talking, we shouldn't be making bombs.
Yeah.
We don't need that doubt to be sown into the American fabric at this moment. It has to be stopped, is how, you know, they saw it. And like, so yeah, apparently if that campaign didn't exist, there was a decent chance that Oppie would have been president.
I like at the end how when they were like,
and Florence Pugh would have been the first lady.
That was a really weird relationship, man, when she was like abusive and
that
shit.
That was weird.
Anyway, so it was really awesome to me when, and this, I mean, the awesome sense of the word, it, at the end when they're like, who is the other dissenter? And the guy was like, some guy out of Boston, Massachusetts. Never heard of him. Some guy named Robert Kennedy.
No, it was JFK.
Sorry, got his name wrong. It's John Kennedy.
That would be great. He's like, some guy named Jonathan Fitzgerald Kennedy, who we will call JFK. but I mean that was such a great moment because it was like a history nerd being hit with like a real world Easter egg.
Yeah.
You know, like the same way, like remember back in the day, I think it was in Captain America Civil War, when they were like, and then Dr. Stephen Strange, and all of us are like,
oh shit. with the Albert Einstein superhero intro and the name drop on a file. Chris Nolan has been watching the MCU for sure, 100%. He loves it.
I just love that, like, we all got it. Like, oh man, so JFK is going to be part of the extended actual real life universe that we live in right now that he was in. Like, there's no extended Oppenheimer.
I can't believe they brought Congress into this one, man. They're going to have a whole Congress, Congress spinoff. Congress series coming to Fox this September, dude. It's in the Oppenheimer universe.
I swear they said JFK in the movie. Yeah, then fucking Nick Fury shows up and he's like hiring assassins to take out the Kennedys because there's a secret invasion of anti-communist stuff or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It would be huge. The other criticism that I saw people saying, and if you feel comfortable commenting on it, was that there was not a single point of view depicted in the movie of Japan or the Japanese people and their experience or response to the bomb. And where I've been hanging out online, it was a criticism that was mostly dismissed, and I would say correctly so, because it's like, you know, we do have the scene where Oppenheimer is watching the footage of the aftermath and feeling very uncomfortable. But I feel like if you're going to put that in the movie, then that has to be what the movie's about, because it's deserving of a movie. And Oppenheimer's not about that. It's about Oppenheimer. And I would say personally that it very clearly painted the ghastliness of what we did. I would say in a fair and honest and, you know, not apologetic, but knowing way. But I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Nothing that's concrete. I think that it wasn't, again, something that I noticed until you pointed it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. I'm not the type that would notice it, but that's the criticism that I've read.
Yeah, man, it's tough because I do think that you're right. It doesn't make the movie about Oppenheimer anymore, I think.
Yeah.
Which,
well,
is not great.
It's the kind of movie that if... Oh, good. I'm sorry. I made my point. It's your turn.
No, I mean, I don't really have a point other than, like, I didn't have an issue with... Because I think, like, you know, how much of... Do we want to get into the grotesque category? And then you kind of lose your credibility of just telling a story about the weakness of humanity, which is exploring beyond their means and beyond their grasp. And I think that having the effects or the consequences of what this particular instance of that was, the way that they show them, was enough for me to still get that sense of guilt as being a human, as being part of the species that will eventually kill itself from its own fucking hubris or what have you. I did feel that kind of weight of the loss of thousands and thousands of other lives. Like, I felt all of that. So that was the thing they were trying to convey. I think they did it in a way without having to subject us to, you know, terribly violent images.
I would agree. I think you're correct, because, you know, it's also one of those things where, like, you know, how much is too much? How much is not enough? It's like a really tough thing, like, to choose to include it. And the thing is, though, like, that's a movie I would watch, one that's entirely in that perspective. But yeah, I think the way you said it, like, leaning into the grotesque, I don't think would have been beneficial to the movie.
I don't think so.
And I think that the grotesquity of concept of what we've done is certainly paid service.
Because it is a horrifying thing, so I will equate it to horror. For me, a lot of the scariest stuff and the shit that I won't watch is the shit like Midsommar and Hereditary, which is not necessarily scary in the jump scare or, like, you know, gore porn, that kind of shit level scary. It's scary because it fucks with your mind. And this movie did that for me.
Well, you did just doom yourself to an episode dedicated to Hereditary.
I'm definitely not watching that movie, dude.
I'll watch it with
too
you.
It's scary.
Have you seen it?
No, but I know what happens.
I think if you watched it with me, you might enjoy it more because you'll see how comedic it actually is. And it's very purposeful. But hey, we'll get into that another time.
We gotta move on to our list. Last thoughts.
I wanted to say about Oppenheimer, perhaps the best compliment that I could give it is when you sit down to see a movie, especially if you do it like I did and see it on the giant premium format IMAX screen, You plan things like bathroom breaks and other such human needs. And you know, I'm going to have to pick a point where I leave the room and miss 2 or 3 minutes of the movie because I got to pee. unless you're like me and you sprint through the theater. And I didn't even, I didn't leave the theater to pee. I didn't pee in the theater. That's not what I'm saying. I didn't pee because it never even occurred to me to think that I might have to pee, because I was absolutely enveloped in this movie from beginning to end. And that is a huge order in terms of my attention span, my bladder size, and just like the bleakness that you're subjecting me to as a filmmaker. And kudos to Oppenheimer. Like, that's the ultimate test to pass. I left for 2 minutes during Avatar 2 because I had to pee, and I loved Avatar 2, and it was spectacle. But it never occurred to me to think to have to pee. Like, my bladder was just disconnected through the entirety of Oppenheimer. And I just, that says it all for me.
So I had a similar experience, but not exactly so much. First of all,
did you see it on a big screen?
I saw it on a bigger screen. I didn't go to Main Street. I went up to King of Prussia to see it really at an actual screen. But it wasn't IMAX.
Did you see it on the IMAX?
No, it wasn't IMAX. It was sold out.
What was it like there? What's theirs called? Because that other one's actually pretty fucking legit.
Yeah, it was. I had a great, it was big enough. And like, my friend Jess, who,
RPX.
When I went to see it with my friends Megan and Jess was like, I thought we weren't seeing an IMAX. Like, this is not an IMAX. So it definitely was bigger than a normal screen.
Chairs are way comfier in RPX, and RPX has great sound.
The chairs were not that comfy. And so let me tell.
Oh, no.
Let me tell the story. So this is the most crowded theater I've been in since Endgame, by the way, which was pretty cool, but I didn't realize that would be the case. And I started to get anxiety, and I got a center seat, and I like halfway through, I like kind of had to pee, and I was like, I can't, I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to get up and go through this crowd to go pee. So just put it off your mind. And so Chris Nolan made such a good movie that I was able to distract myself by not having to pee until the end. But I really had to focus on it. But he made it easy.
I mean,
yeah,
we are both dudes who have to pee in a movie, and neither of us did.
No, I'm good.
Is there anything else to say?
I can go a normal movie length without having to pee. But 3 hours, it's, you know, I'm betting that I have to pee at some point.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I wanted to point out, also just like, because we didn't really get too deeply into it, I just want to say, even though we objectified the shit out of Florence Pugh earlier, she's exceptional in the movie. It is an incredibly realized character in a movie that's not about her. She's like an essential part and is great.
Phenomenal.
And then I believe it's I'm going to fuck up, but I'm going to say India. It might not be India, but there was a foreign version of the film in which they digitally put like a black tube top dress over Florence Pugh's naked body. It was it's like the one piece of like international censorship that this movie suffered. And it's just so funny to me, like, what a prudish thing.
Well, sorry, India.
Yes, I don't know if it was India. Don't quote me on it, but it was just some other country with a different, you know.
Sorry, some other country that name was too ignorant to remember your name of.
I was so distracted by how good she looked, even in the digital slapdash dress that they did.
Slapdash, that's a good brand. They're expensive.
No, the Slapdash Studios.
Yeah.
Do you not like titties, or at least don't want to be seen looking at them? I remember the first trailers for a Scary Movie when they were making fun of the what's up and I see dead people, and in the trailer Marlon Wayans does the I see dead people and all his boys laugh, and in the movie it's much more there's a lot more weed imagery in the photo where he's like, I see dead people. And the guy's like, this is awesome. In the movie, he's holding a joint. If you go back and look at those early trailers, there's a very sloppily done Dorito. He's like, dude, awesome! And it's just holding a Dorito.
That's a great story.
It's a great story. I'm a great man. I have interesting things to say.
You can find one day at MovieCast on every bit.
There's going to be a 3 hour long epic about how good of a man I am. And it's not going to be nuanced because there is no nuance here.
I wonder who's going to play
it's
me.
Just going to be about how brilliant I am and how my life is now the greatest story ever told, not the Bible. Get the fuck out of here, Jesus, you nerd. We harnessed the power of the sun, and then Dan Scully talked about it thoughtfully. All right, I'm going to calm down.
Who plays you? I don't think I've...
Me! This is happening next year. It's me. And if not me...
Who plays me?
Marlon Wayans. And it's going to be amazing.
Dude, that's the second time that somebody randomly has mentioned Marlon Wayans to me.
It happens. It's because that's what I think of when I see you, Steven.
He'll be happy to know that you think Marlon Wayans should play me in the biopic of your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because when you look at me, you go, that biopic is going to be Keenan and Ivory Wayans. Yeah. So you will assume Marlon Wayans is there.
Yeah.
I watching one of these scary movies, I was looking through the credits, and like even in like supporting tech roles, there's Wayanses everywhere. They're like a dynasty of just talented people. Like I remember there was a Craig Wayans. I was like, I've never even heard of that Wayans, but there's no way he's in the credits for Scary Movie and he isn't part of the Coppola Wayans.
Soon it'll be a real Wayans world.
You just earned yourself a biopic, my friend, because that was goddamn genius.
I earned myself a biopic, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
Also, before we leave Oppenheimer to do our lists, one thing I want to say is that one of the big draws to this movie was that Christopher Nolan apparently made all of the effects of the atom bomb entirely in camera and not through CGI. I'm sure they were sweetened in post, but like all of the effects were done. They were not computer generated. And I don't know how he did it. It's not like anything there felt impossible to me, but everything really did look real. And I think that that's cool. And I think that Christopher Nolan is doing his damnedest to preserve tangible film and to try and make things as real as possible in front of the camera. And I just want to say respect.
Yeah, same.
Oppenheimer, perfect, brilliant movie.
Oppenheimer, go see it in the theaters.
I actually am considering seeing it again on a premium format because it's
premium.
I would just want to see it again. It was so good. All right, should we do our lists?
Sure.
So in honor of Oppenheimer, we are counting down some of our favorite nonfiction historical movies.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a loose thing. I have, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8. I have 9 listed.
I have 5.
And we're not going to go through all of them. So we're only going to do 5. Do you want to start? Or do you want me to start?
I'll start.
All right. What do you got?
This one's a little complicated. It's Terminator Salvation.
Okay. I'm listening. Sell me on it.
No, just kidding. I just wanted to see what your reaction would be. And of course, your reaction is not what I wanted.
Well, you're the guy who brought all the Cars movies to a list.
That's not a real movie based on history. And I say, Dan, it hasn't happened yet. And then you say, oh, shucks, that's funny. And then everyone in the audience laughs and claps at my joke.
Well, you did the car bit. And it was such a good bit because I didn't resist that I thought you were going to really try and sell me on Salvation as a real history movie. And so I was trying to be open-minded to open us up to whatever crazy argument you may have had. I wanted to hear it. I want to hear someone do that. I thought it was going to be you, but you failed me. We failed each other, essentially, is what's happening.
My number 5 movie is Troy.
Yo, nice. Okay. I haven't seen that since the theater.
Troy, I really hated when I saw it in the theater. And then I was like, this is stupid. Why is there helmet vision? This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. This movie sucks. But this is also the year that I decided I want to go to film school. So I hated every movie except for the Boondock Saints. And so I think I couldn't really gauge what was good at the time. And then I revisited it. It happened to me on TV, I think. In the last couple of years, I'm like, this movie, I did not give this movie credit. It's actually pretty damn good. And I really liked it.
I remember it was the first time I ever saw the Trojan horse depicted as something that could have been believably built by the people on screen.
Yeah.
Like, it felt kind of like bespoke and you know, like rigorously conceived as opposed to like fantastical. And I really appreciated that about it. But I've honestly only seen it the one time, and I don't remember much beyond like that general feeling.
It was pretty good. I think it would be a good revisit, I think, if you have the time.
We could do an episode on it. That would be kind of fun.
I'm fucking sure I'll do that.
I'll tell you one thing. I don't remember the last time Eric Bana was in something, and I think he's like a truly tremendous talent. But
Munich almost made my list, actually.
Munich did make my list, but not for a little bit. So we'll get to it when we get to it.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. All right. So my number five is The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Also almost made my list.
Nice. And I should say too before long, I get into all of
way
this.
Way too long and way too slow of a burn, but I'll let you keep going.
I would have put Zodiac in all five of these slots, except I've talked Zodiac to death on this podcast over the last decade. So I just decided to leave it.
Oh man, we lost Dan a little bit. Oh no.
Coward Robert Ford. Oh, did we lose?
Yeah, we lost. You have to start over.
Okay, so I just ranted and raved and said I'd put Zodiac in all five slots if I could, but Zodiac has appeared on so many lists on this show over the years that I just left it off as a rule because the world knows that I think Zodiac is just
I the also best. Left it off because it's perfect, so
it's perfect, yeah. So The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. It's another one of those big, like, three-hour-long movies. But there's apparently a 5.5-hour cut that I would love to see.
Why?
But because Andrew Dominik's a genius, and I just want to see what he shot for this. But I also watched all 5 Exorcist movies over the last week, and all 4 Jaws movies before that, including an Italian ripoff that was called Jaws 5, even though it really wasn't Jaws 5. So I will watch things, is the moral of the story. But The Assassination of Jesse James, what's so cool about it is it's like an anti-Western in that the West, the old West we see as like gritty and cool. And it's not that, but we forget that like everybody stank. It was fucking disgusting. You know, it was a very shitty quality of life in a very precariously upheld society because it existed of us stamping out a pre-existing society. It's like, it's not a beautiful place. And even though we often see it depicted as gritty, we don't really see it depicted as ugly. And so this is pretty ugly, but it also like demystifies the Wild West characters while also like mythologizing them anew. Yeah. And so it preserves all that while still being really realistic and just like everyone's great in it. Casey Affleck is fucking phenomenal in it. And it's just it's just an awesome Western. And you know, it goes deeper than, you know, like we all love Tombstone, but like Tombstone can be a little bit cartoony. You know, this just feels like someone dipped a camera back then. And, you know, Brad Pitt was also there because nobody looked like Brad Pitt back then.
There was a real quick back to Oppenheimer. There was a Casey Affleck also kind of got a superhero intro too, because they were like,
yeah,
they didn't show his face, but like you heard his voice. I'm like, wait a minute. I know that voice. What is that voice? That
Casey Affleck.
And then they like slowly pan around and it's like, ladies and gentlemen, Casey Affleck. Yeah.
So yeah, number 5, Assassination of Jesse James. If you ain't seen it, go see it. It's great.
My number 4 is The Trial of Chicago 7.
Ooh, okay. Another Sorkin.
Sorkin is at his most Sorkiniest, and I love that in a courtroom drama setting. And I think that the flashbacks intertwined in between that narrative were expertly done. And I think that overall the film was really just technically well done, well acted, well written, well directed. And it was a shining light also in the moment of the pandemic when I was really needed a good movie to come out, and it did.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoyed that as not only as a film that exists today, but in the moment when it existed in my life when it came out.
When that movie dropped on Netflix, that was one that I always planned to watch, but I wasn't going to frontline it. But it was you raving about it that made me press play on it. And yeah, that's a cool movie.
It was really good.
if you look up the real story of that too, like a lot of what they show in the movie is a lot of it's accurate, but a lot of it that's not accurate is actually made less fucked up in the movie.
Yeah.
Like the way that, is it Bobby Seals? Is that his name? The Black Panther guy, the way he was treated in the courtroom is actually considerably worse. It's really horrifying. My number four.
That surprised me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the worst thing about it is that it's not surprising. My number four is All the President's Men.
Nice.
The story of the Watergate scandal.
Which one?
With Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. What was that?
The first one?
What do you mean?
They remade it with Robert Redford in like 2007.
Did they? Because he's in the original.
Yeah, he's in the second one,
All
too.
All the President's Men? I didn't know they remade it, but well... The original is fantastic, gave rise to the mythology of Deep Throat. And it's just like when it comes to mixing political conspiracy movies and one of my favorite subgenres, the people at work movie, it like finds the sweet spot between the two and just absolutely crushes. And I think there's shades of Oppenheimer within it. So All the President's Men.
I think I'm being Mandela.
You might be being Mandela, but how about I research it while you tell me your number three, because we're coming up on the end.
Yeah, sorry. Number three, Hidden Figures. I like this movie because it's. I also love, much like Oppenheimer, I love movies about science because they make me feel like I'm in on it, you know? And this movie also has a lot of really great, you know, uplifting moments in relations to... you know, breaking glass ceilings and civil rights movements and things like that. And it's just a feel-good story about three women who, you know, wouldn't take no for an answer and knew that they had the best skills in the room and proved it that way and in various aspects of NASA. And I think that it's just a really, every time it's on, I kind of leave it on because I know it's going to make me feel good.
That was the first movie that at the end of it, I was like, Janelle Monáe is going to be huge.
Janelle Monáe is one of the most talented media moguls of our generation.
Yeah.
And the fact that she is not heavily in the spotlight does her a benefit, I think, because she's able to produce more.
Yeah. I feel like the stuff that she produces often feels, comparatively to other people in her world, feels more like it's coming from her as opposed to coming from like a team.
Agreed.
In 2013, they did a 2-hour special about All the President's Men called All the President's Men Revisited. And it was just a special about it that Robert Redford is in. Naturally, he would be.
Yeah.
All right. My number three is Bonnie and Clyde, because it very similarly is kind of the first to do what I lauded Assassination of Jesse James of doing, by taking a mythologized world, making it a little bit more realistic, still putting beautiful people in it. You know, it's Faye Dunaway and why am I blanking on his name? And Warren Beatty. And it's funny, when I see him, I just think of Annette Bening because they're married, but like my brain goes to her, I guess, because of American Beauty. But yeah, it just takes a heavily mythologized history, reminds us of how fucked up it is, but keeps it in Hollywood. And it did it during that new Hollywood transition, which is an era in movies that I just love. And there's a fuck ton of squibs at the end. So that's all I need. Bonnie and Clyde, number three. What's your number two?
The Great Escape.
Yo.
Which is Steve McQueen jumps over the defense. And I love this movie because it's your classic old school war movie where, you know, the hero's pretty much Han Solo or whatever. All the archetypes that Han Solo was based on, he's that cool. And, you know, I remember being in like fifth grade and we watched this movie in social studies and we watched it over the course of every period for a week. And at the beginning of the movie, everybody got a card, and on that card was a character in the movie. And as that character was eliminated from the movie, you had to move your seat to the back of the class. And anybody still alive at the end of the movie, I put that in air quotes, anybody still alive at the end of the movie got like a candy bar or something at the end of the week when we finished the film.
That's a really, really fun exercise.
I got killed.
It's a great flick. I simply watched it because I had just finished reading the book adaptation of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and because this very heavily features into that. So I only just recently saw it, but I frequently get the theme stuck in my head.
But that movie was like I said, I was in fifth grade, and that's the first movie I remember watching. I'm like, wow, movies are so fucking cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a damn good one.
Yeah.
I never really understood why Steve McQueen was considered so cool, because I always found him kind of dweeby.
Me too.
But like the 1-2 punch of The Great Escape and Bullet made me get it a little bit more.
Yeah, same.
All right. I don't want to run up against the end. So, all right, here we go. So number two is Munich. Munich is a movie that I have seen once front to back, and then just like on TV, just like on TV when it's on in the background. And I think what's so cool about Munich is that's a movie that I actually did not know any aspect of that story going into it. And so not only is it a story with Eric Bana, it also was a movie that like literally taught me everything that I knew about that story in the moment. I had no historical context for it. And then I was able to get historical context afterwards. It like sparked my curiosity, but like, it's just a piece of cinema that is indelibly burned into my mind. And I've probably told this on the podcast before, but it has that one scene where Eric Bana is at the bar and this beautiful woman, just like so beautiful, not hot, gorgeous, starts flirting with him. And it's a good flirt. He can get laid tonight for sure. And she's way out of his league. And he says, "I'm married, leave me alone." And she leaves him alone. And then the next day, his buddy who he's traveling with is found dead in his hotel room because that lady, who was a hitman, killed his buddy. And that scene is crazy because the whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, why aren't you sleeping with this lady? Oh, yes, you're married. You're a good man. Yeah, good move. But I'm sitting there going, she might have got me. She might have killed me. It's such a good come on. And so that scene says so much about Eric Bana's character, where he's like, no, I am committed to goodness. I will not forsake my wife. And it saves his fucking life because she was just trying to kill him. It was too good to be true. And that scene has stuck with me forever. And like, that is the magic of Spielberg right there, is that scene told me everything I needed to know. Munich is like, I think it's actually one of the all times. I think it's better than Schindler's List, but you know, in terms of Spielberg stuff. But yeah, that's my number two.
My number one is W.
I saw that in the theater, dude.
Fucking love W so much, dude. Josh Brolin gives the performance of a lifetime as George.
Yeah, he's great.
Fucking Tandy Way Newton as Condoleezza Rice absolutely kills it as Condoleezza Rice. And like, it is... while it is parody, at the same time, it is essentially a biopic. And I'll keep it short here because we're up against it. But essentially, this movie taught me, because I again saw this at a young age. So it came out in probably like, what, 2003, 2004? So I was like just graduating high school. And I realized that this movie taught me sometimes people aren't inherently evil. They're just really fucking stupid.
Yeah. And my takeaway from that movie, I remember walking away and just being like, oh, he's not the bad guy. He's the idiot. And he's surrounded by bad guys.
Surrounded by people who
want to like says so much about politics. Yeah. Yeah. That's
all he wanted to do. All he wanted to do was own a baseball team.
But what didn't it happen at the beginning where it's like a fantastical moment where he's going to catch a fly ball and it bonks him in the head instead? Yeah. That has stuck with me forever. That's fucking great. My number one, I don't have much to say about, but it's the movie I thought of the most watching Oppenheimer, Good Night and Good Luck, the Edward story about Edward R. Murrow going up against McCarthyism. And he's going through that same kind of trial and tribulation that Oppie is going through by the end of the movie. And also, it's just got a real bang up performance from Robert Downey Jr. But it's like a great flick. Clooney knocked it out of the park in directing that. But we're almost out of time here, so I won't get too deep. You can find everything about the show at MovieMovieCast. You can find our other show at Hot Property Pod. You can find everything I do at ScullyVision.com. Okay. And stay tuned for exciting stuff. We're going to try and do Barbie next time around, but it might be something else. Stay tuned to the socials.
And that's been I Like to Movie Movie. And as always, bye.